Hey, it's Ben Greenfield. I just emerged from 5 days immersed in a wilderness survival program with my children. And needless to say, I was completely unplugged and didn't do much podcasting during that time. So in lieu of today's normal podcast, I'm releasing a special interview with the one and only Tim Ferriss.
Well, if you're like me, you live a busy life. You don't really have time for many days off. That's why I talk so much about your mitochondria, because they generate about 90% of the energy your body uses. And keeping your mitochondria strong is one of the best ways to keep fatigue at bay. But these little mitochondria, darn things, are expensive to run. They use a huge amount of raw materials, especially when it comes to minerals. The problem is most people, including you and me, probably don't get enough minerals. And without minerals, your mitochondria don't have the cofactors they need to make energy. More than 97% of Americans don't get enough potassium. About 80% are deficient in magnesium. 40% are deficient in calcium. And those are three of the big ones. There's close to a dozen other trace minerals that are important for mitochondrial function, and most of us don't get enough of them, and you definitely can't get them from, say, table salt. It turns out that trying to take all the minerals you need by taking single mineral supplements isn't only hard because you need a ton of pills, but it's not the most effective way to get your minerals. That's why I take liquid, humic, and fulvic complexes. These are full spectrum mineral supplements, which means you get all the essential minerals your body needs in one go without a daily handful of massive amounts of pills or very large capsules or anything else that's hard to swallow. I use Beam mineral supplements because they're almost 100% bioavailable. They come in a liquid form that's easy to drink. Just two bottles. I keep them in my pantry, throw back a shot a few times a day. They're a great way to refill your mineral stores, especially for those of you out here who are haunting your sauna on a frequent basis, or sweating, or doing hot yoga, or anything else. Keep your mitochondria running strong. So if you want to up your mineral game, give Beam Minerals a try. Go to Beam Minerals, B-E-A-M, minerals.com, and use code BEN at checkout for 20% off your first order. Well, if you're tired of spending hours on cardio with minimal results, then listen up, because I got a game-changing fitness breakthrough for you. The Carol Bike, science-backed, time-saving solution trusted by experts for optimizing health and longevity. They use this special form of a workout called a rehit, which allows you to achieve superior health and fitness benefits compared to regular cardio in 90% less time. That's amazing. That's a lot of time, 90%. Studies show that by doing Carol's 5-minute workout just 3 times a week, you can improve your fitness by 12%, reduce your risk of type 2 diabetes by 62%, and even wind back your internal body clock by 10 years. The science is clear. Carol Bike is your ticket to a healthier and more vibrant life. You got to try it to believe it and to see what I'm saying. I mean, it's not like a walk in the park. When you're pushing hard in those intervals, you're pushing, but then it's just like over and it's done and it walks you through it. It's very motivating. It's 5 feet away from me right now. It's right here in my office. My cool little exercise toy in my office. So you get $250 off your Carol Bike. You don't have to wait any longer. You can join over 25,000 riders and visit carolbike.com today. carolbike.com. Hey, you want to spice things up in the bedroom and boost your sexual performance and do it naturally without nasty prescription drugs? You got to check out this stuff, Joy Mode. It's a powder. You put it in water, or if you're like me and you're a savage, you can dry powder into your mouth. Contains clinically supported doses of L-citrulline, arginine, yohimbine, and vitamin C. So after taking this stuff called their Sexual Performance Booster, again by Joy Mode, your blood levels of arginine and yohimbine increase, and that directly promotes nitric oxide production, penile tissue relaxation, and increased drive. Well, the antioxidant action of vitamin C protects the nitric oxide from oxidative degradation, which then enhances the blood flow promoting activity of the nitric oxide. They thought of everything. They're super smart over at Joy Mode, and collectively these effects enhance sex drive and blood flow naturally to the penis or to the clitoris. My wife takes it too. It's amazing. You get better orgasms, better blood flow. You can kiss nasty prescription medications goodbye and have natural guilt-free energy for boosting your sexual performance. You can get 20% off your first order from Joy Mode. How? Go to usejoymode.com/greenfield. That's usejoymode.com/greenfield. J-O-Y. usejoymode.com/greenfield. They'll give you 20% off your first order.
In this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast.
But as long as you manage your sodium and potassium and so on, I can get by on, say, 6 hours instead of 8 hours of sleep and operate with no handicap. I did the 4 or 5 blood tests a day with the Precision Extra for my keto levels, and I feel like now, after doing that for 2 weeks or so, that I can tell roughly where my ketones and glucose are. There's no biochemical free lunch, whether it's with smart drugs or anabolics or otherwise. The body is very, very smart and will compensate by down-regulating receptors or decreasing natural endogenous production of fill-in-the-blank. And in almost every case, there's some type of social or financial pressure, or a reward, or some type of loss or punishment.
Welcome to the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast. We provide you with everything you need to know for total performance, fat loss, recovery, digestion, sleep, brain, and hormone optimization. So whether you're an Ironman triathlete or you just want to shed a few pounds, get ready for non-run-of-the-mill cutting-edge content from BenGreenfieldFitness.com.
Hey folks, it's Ben Greenfield here, and today I am presenting to you a guy who is no stranger to the Ben Greenfield Fitness Show, Tim Ferriss. Now, 3 years ago, Tim appeared on this show with Ray Cronise in the episode Tim Ferriss and Ray Cronise Explain How to Manipulate Your Body's Temperature to Burn More Fat. Then 2 years ago, he returned with the Tim Ferriss Cold Thermogenesis episode. Well, now Tim is back because, believe it or not, he knows how to do more than just freeze his balls off. As a matter of fact, Tim, who's well known as a relentless self-experimenter and author and now TV star, has just launched the Tim Ferriss Experiment, which is available on iTunes and probably other places too, I would imagine. And so far, I've watched the tactical shooting episode, the rock and roll drumming episode, and I've queued up the urban escape and evasion episode to watch next. Now, if you want to check out any of the episodes or any of the resources Tim and I talk about, just go to BenGreenfieldFitness.com/TimTim. And at BenGreenfieldFitness.com/TimTim, you can check out everything that Tim and I talk about today. But Tim is also up to other things. The last time I saw you, Tim, you were eating copious amounts of cheese at a castle in Napa Valley. And so I think that's a perfect place to jump in. What is the deal with the cheese?
You know, I've dialed back on the cheese a little bit because I felt like I was having it pushed through my pores like a human cheesecloth. But I have been experimenting with ketosis and the ketogenic diet again after about a 10-year hiatus. I followed the cyclical ketogenic diet in college, in parts of college, and experimented with different types of carb loading in combination with ketosis. But this time around, I'm doing pretty much plain Jane ketosis, but measuring it this time around with better tools, like you and I have discussed. So instead of using the keto sticks in your analysis, using the Precision Extra primarily for beta hydroxybutyrate. But as part of that, as you are very familiar, you consume 70 to 80% of your calories typically from fat, and it's a very boring diet for the most part. But cheese is a very easy, portable way to have fat on the go. And it's a lot less messy than having like Kerrygold splattered all over your laptop and books in your backpack. So that was the explanation for the cheese.
Yeah. And fewer diaper moments potentially compared to MCT oil.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Much less frequent disaster pants for sure.
I'm curious though, when I had Peter Attia on the show, we talked about how ketosis is definitely advantageous for economy and efficiency, particularly for endurance. Now, I know you're not like a big triathlete or marathoner. So what was your motivation for using ketosis?
Yeah, my motivation was multifold. Number one, with the new tools at my disposal for measurement, I really just wanted to look at blood marker changes in following the ketogenic diet. And secondly, I knew I was coming up on a TV launch for the Tim Ferriss Experiment, and I wanted to be, number one, very sharp mentally, and the brain runs very well with ketones, and wanted to be able to operate at a high level cognitively, even in sleep deficit or compared to my normal requirements. And pretty typical that as long as you manage your sodium and potassium and so on, intake, and generally that means increasing your sodium intake pretty dramatically, I can get by on, say, 6 hours instead of 8 hours of sleep and operate at with no handicap mentally. So those were a few of the incentives and reasons for wanting to use the ketogenic diet. Lastly, it just makes scheduling a lot easier in so much as I don't have to take an hour-long lunch break if I'm on a ketogenic diet, because I can simply have coconut oil in tea and be fine fasting, I mean, multiple days if necessary, but generally speaking, having one primary meal at dinner time. So it, for a host of reasons, it was the optimal diet for a very breakneck schedule that was highly dependent on cognitive performance.
Now, I'm curious, if you mentioned that you were tracking some biomarkers or planning on tracking some biomarkers as you do ketosis. Have you done much of that yet, like taking blood measurements?
You know, I have some stuff pending. And what I have noticed, you know, I could probably pull some of them up, but I don't want to chew up too much time.
My motivation for asking is that when I did ketosis, two biomarkers that I actually was a little bit disappointed in were thyroid and testosterone, and of course those can manifest in symptoms like, you know, being cold a little bit more often or low libido, for example. Have you experienced any deficits like that in ketosis?
You know, it's interesting that you ask, because the two things that come to mind, because I've done a lot of blood testing, and what was very interesting to me about my response to ketosis, but not my response to ketosis was similar in so much. Similar to my fasting experiments, in so much as both of them seem to make my sex hormone binding globulin skyrocket. Mm. And for those people who are not familiar with sex hormone binding globulin, among other things, it can render your total testosterone very irrelevant, because it will bind to androgens like testosterone, and you don't get some of the nice benefits of that anabolic and androgenic hormone. So the right. Now on the at the same time though, I was looking at my blood tests, and I'm not doing anything. I'm not taking any extracurricular pills or injections at the moment. My testosterone, my free testosterone, and obviously these lab values and ranges depend on the lab you're using, but went from somewhere around 720 to way up at the top end of the range at like 960 or 970. So my testosterone has actually substantially increased. But if you look at my sex hormone binding globulin, I think with the LabCorp results, the highest range of normal is something like 50, and my sex hormone binding globulin was 100.
Yeah.
So I don't know what to make of that. I will say, though, that I have been in the last week or so experimenting with basically carb backloading at the end of a ketogenic day,
mm-hmm.
where I'll weight train and then have a higher carbohydrate meal during dinner. And I did this partially because I was at an extended friend's birthday party and didn't want to be that one guy who didn't enjoy any of the food. So I was like, all right, if I know I'm going to party at night, I'm going to fast primarily for the beginning of the day. And I've probably put on 15 pounds of muscle since you saw me, and that was not that long ago.
Yeah.
Wow. So it's been pretty fascinating, sort of inadvertent or haphazard carb backloading plus like 2/3 ketosis has been kind of interesting.
That's interesting that you settled on that, because backloading is basically what saved me from a lot of the deficits I was experiencing during ketosis, you know, and basically backloading,
really?
It's essentially cyclic ketosis. What I found from testing is that you can easily be back in ketosis by the next morning after, you know, falling out of the low or no carb scenario in the evening. And especially if you stack that carb backload post activity, it's extremely anabolic, which is, you know, probably why you experience the muscle gains. And that's interesting with sex hormone binding globulin as well, that it still stayed elevated, because I guess, well, my question for you is, are you doing more like calorie restricted ketosis, where you're getting into ketosis because you're so low on calories, or are you achieving it more from just shoving so many fats into your body that you're generating an ungodly amount of ketones?
I like to kickstart it with fasting. So it's not low calorie, it's zero calorie. I like to kickstart ketosis with very low calorie. But if you look at my total daily caloric consumption, I do not think I am sub-maintenance at all. Because my dinners can be pretty massive. And I had two dinners yesterday. That was most of the two social engagements, but two very high-fat dinners. What I find is that the muscle gain has been very surprising to me just because my protein intake is so low compared to any type of sort of conventional weight training wisdom, if you want to call it that, maybe in quotation marks, would say, you know, pound 1 gram of protein per, say, desired pound of lean body weight or something like that. And I'm getting nowhere close to that. I mean, I'm getting probably, I would say, at most, 1 gram per kilogram of body weight.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm getting, you know, 50 to 70 grams of protein per day, maybe, on the high end. And so I've just been kind of dumbfounded at how rapid the muscle gain has been, which, I mean, obviously there's a highly anabolic component to insulin and carb backloading and so on, but I've still been kind of puzzled, and it's been really fascinating to observe.
Yeah, and it's very strange because it actually doesn't really follow what you would expect from a biochemical standpoint. There was a study, I believe it was at University of California back in 2008, where they had women on a calorie-restricted 800-calorie-a-day diet, and they were still packing on lean muscle. So there's something going on biochemically that we don't quite yet understand as far as like satellite cell proliferation and muscle fiber maintenance or growth, even in the absence of calories. So that's interesting.
Yeah, it's really, yeah. Anyway, we could geek out on this for a long time, but yeah, it's very odd, but very exciting to me at the same time.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, I'm excited to see some of the results that you get. Are you eventually going to release on your blog any like results of like blood tracking or biomarkers or things of that nature?
I might. I'm definitely tracking it all and logging it all, but what form that will take, I'm not sure in terms of writing.
Gotcha.
I feel like I still have more research to do, and the fact that I can't pinpoint why I'm gaining as much muscular weight as I am given my intake will bother me. So I feel like I need to do some more testing to at least come up with some hypotheses. But I am logging all the data. So I have all the blood tests and all that stuff.
And to your knowledge, no one is secretly injecting horse steroids into your right butt cheek or anything like that.
You know, yeah, I've been waking up with these bruises on my upper outer quadrant of my right buttock. But besides that, everything's great.
It's so weird. So are you
the bovine use only toothpaste, maybe? I don't know.
Speaking of waking up with bruises on your butt cheek, do you actually do any daily quantification these days of other variables? Like, we have a lot of listeners who self-quantify things like sleep and heart rate variability, things like that. And obviously, you know, there was an entire section of the Consumer Electronics Show this year devoted to just wearables. Are you really using many of those things or doing much tracking and self-quantifying these days, aside from tracking some of these ketosis markers?
I am not. And part of the reason is that the vast majority of the wearables right now are accelerometers. And I just don't find accelerometry very interesting if it's being used for counting steps, for instance. But what I've been trying to do is to basically synchronize my perception with tracking devices. And what I mean by that is I did maybe 4 or 5 blood tests a day with the Precision Extra for my ketone levels. And I feel like now, after doing that for 2 weeks or so and noting down my mental state and my mood and my irritability on like a 0 to 10 scale and so on, that I can tell roughly where my ketones and glucose are. And in fact, and if you want to see, this was not pure luck. I mean, there's a little bit of luck, but if you watched the last random show I did, this video show I did with Kevin Rose, I was like, you know, I bet your ketones are around 0.3 millimolars. And he tested it and he was 0.3 millimolars. It was insane. And for myself, I'm like, okay, I can kind of tell when I'm now between 1.1 or 1.7 millimolars, for instance.
Right.
So I'm doing the tracking to calibrate my brain and observational skills so that I no longer need the device. But right now, I'm not wearing any trackables or anything like that.
Okay, yeah, that makes, well, this podcast was originally going to be sponsored by Precision Extra ketone monitoring, but I'll have to I'll have to let them know.
Yeah, if you could get me some strips for less than $5 a piece, I'd be really excited.
Seriously, yeah, I switched to breath for a while during my experimentation, then settled on the same thing as you did, that it's pretty easy to feel whether or not you're in ketosis, and even in a deep state of ketosis, once you get to know what it actually feels like.
Yep.
So in addition to using ketosis for accelerating learning or for enhancing focus, concentration, et cetera, during your filming of the Tim Ferriss experiment, did you use other things like neurotropics, smart drugs, supplements, things of that nature?
Yeah. During the Tim Ferriss experiment, I was following slow carb and with the Saturday cheat day and not ketosis, just because the travel schedule and so on was so insane that I found it at the time. And also because I was actually, for a host of reasons, mostly convenience related, I just found slow carb to be a more compatible diet for that period of time. The other tools that I use would include, and I think this is actually an important point to make for folks, is that you don't need to be, quote, in ketosis, i.e. deep ketosis, to produce ketones. So I would consume, I would very often fast until lunch while filming, and I would have coconut oil, sometimes a tablespoon or two of caprylic acid, which is sort of a fractionated version of MCT oil.
Yeah, damn tasty stuff.
Oh, it's delicious. Yeah, jet fuel. It's not quite as bad as the synthetic ketones, but it's pretty bad. So I would have that with tea, which was pu'er tea, which is a fermented black tea, plus turmeric and ginger. Mm. And that is still to this day kind of my morning cocktail. And particularly with coconut oil, it really just sets the tone for the rest of the day. I didn't use a ton of pills and potions, partially because, or outside of, in some cases, prescription medication that I had to take from all the injuries. I mean, so in the parkour episodes, like I tore 3 out of 4 quadriceps in both legs, had partially torn ACLs, torn infraspinatus in my left shoulder, torn flexor muscles in my right forearm. It was a mess. So I had anti-inflammatories, and I had some really powerful painkillers and whatnot that I did not end up using, but I had them just in case. Jiu-jitsu, same story, kind of like broken floating rib on the first day of 5 days of shooting with, you know, Marcelo Garcia, like the Michael Jordan of the sport. So I didn't want to put a heavy burden on my liver by adding anything additional if I was taking any type of, say, even ibuprofen.
Yeah.
And that having been said, there were a couple of episodes where I had a respite from the physical abuse, like the language learning episode, where I had to try to learn Tagalog, Filipino, well enough in 3 or 4 days to get interviewed on live TV in Tagalog for 6 minutes, I guess, which is a long time. I was playing around with a stack that works for me, although it's a very controversial stack that some people feel biochemically doesn't make sense. But Siltep is the general name of the stack, but it includes typically, I think it's, Forskolin and artichoke extract is another way to sort of MacGyver a similar effect if it's combined with, say, caffeine. And I respond very well to that. But what I have found is that there's no biochemical free lunch, whether it's with smart drugs or anabolics or otherwise. The body is very, very smart and will compensate by down-regulating receptors or decreasing natural sort of endogenous production of fill-in-the-blank. And that is problematic if I am filming 13 episodes in 16 weeks and I need to be on point every single day. Right. I can't afford to have 2 down days. Whether you're taking ecstasy or taking modafinil or taking whatever, for a lot of people, there is a neurotransmitter and biochemical recovery period where you suck for a period of time. And I couldn't afford that. So I was predominantly, occasionally messing with something like a Siltep, or even like a hydrogen. And obviously, guys, I'm not a doctor. Don't play with it on the internet. Hydrogen is very interesting, but that's a, you know, prescription medication typically in Europe used for dementia and things like that.
Yeah.
But predominantly, I can count on maybe one hand the number of times that I use that stuff. I was relying primarily on fats and different types of stimulants found in tea. I also used the yerba mate, which is very interesting because you have not only the pharmacokinetics of caffeine, where you have just a graph, imagine that, people listening, that shows you kind of where it peaks and where it starts dropping off. I'm a caffeine fast metabolizer, so if I have coffee by itself without fats, I crash within about 20 to 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have something like yerba mate tea, you have not only caffeine, but you have theophylline, which is what you find in green tea, theobromine, which you find in dark chocolate, and all of those combined, since they have different graphs and different peaking periods and half-lives and whatnot, I get a nice 2 to 3 hour period of like a 20% mental gain. So I was mostly taking that type of moderate approach because I was trying to ensure that I wouldn't crash and screw up a very insane Felding schedule.
Now you mentioned something interesting there about caffeine metabolizing, and we've certainly interviewed folks from genetic testing services before and have mentioned the fact that some people are slow or fast caffeine metabolizers, but you talked about how mixing coffee or caffeine with fat seems to slow the effect. In terms of how that actually works, have you looked into that at all to and talk to other fast caffeine metabolizers who have found the same thing, or was that just something you came upon?
I haven't. It's something that I chanced upon.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there are a couple of ways to look at it. And you know, one of my heroes is Richard Feynman, the physicist, and he has a quote along the lines of, you know, the most important thing is not to fool yourself, and you are the easiest person to fool. So I think that on one hand, I'm inclined to want to say, okay, hypothesis A is that there's something fat soluble in coffee that binds to, say, coconut oil, and that affects the metabolizing, the metabolizing of the caffeine or whatever. It could be that something in the coffee besides the caffeine is making me tired 30 minutes later, and that is what is being somehow bound to and excreted, right? Who knows?
Right.
It could also be that the fat is not extending the effects of caffeine. It's just that the MCTs are getting converted into ketones around the same time that I would normally crash.
Yeah.
So that I'm actually still crashing, but the coconut oil is compensating for that by juicing the system with ketones.
Yeah.
I don't know which of those is accurate. I just know that if I add a tablespoon or two of coconut oil, oddly enough, and this could be complete placebo effect, I find that the coconut oil appears to be more effective with the tea that I use, and butter appears to be more effective with the coffee that I tend to drink.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be complete BS, but for whatever reason, that is generally how I combine things.
Yeah, that's interesting. And my understanding of it from a caffeine standpoint is that there are a couple of psychoactive terpenes in coffee. Caffeostol and kawael are these terpenes. And I believe they're carried across the blood-brain barrier when enveloped in fats. And those are normally not molecules that you would feel if you had a cup of coffee in the absence of fats. And so I think that's kind of the trick to this whole, like, you know, blending whatever, any caffeine source, like a yerba mate or a coffee with an oil source like an MCT. But it's real. I'm a fast caffeine metabolizer, but I honestly don't really do a lot of fats blended with coffee. But this has made me think a little bit about maybe starting to do that a bit more. Now, I want to make sure we get a chance to talk about a few of the very cool adventures that you've been on during the course of filming the Tim Ferriss experiment. For example, you did jiu-jitsu, and one of the things that you wound up doing as part of your rapid learning of jiu-jitsu was a choking challenge. What exactly is a choking challenge, and how'd that go down?
Yeah, the choking challenge was, I'm in New York City right now, and it was held here at the Marcelo Garcia Academy, which is one of the most dominant competitive jiu-jitsu schools in the world. Marcelo Garcia is like a 10-time world champion, so he's pretty much the undisputed best grappler in the world. Many people think who's ever walked the face of the planet. And so I was training with him. And at the end of, those 4 days, I had to roll with this, world-class brown belt, who's now a black belt, just choked out one of the Gracies, to try to apply the guillotine choke as many times as possible. And I think it might have been a 3-minute period of time or something, or maybe 60 seconds. I can't recall offhand. And, the point was during the week to try to learn the macro from the micro. And I think this applies to many, many different things, but to not try to learn jujitsu per se, because it's too broad, just like learn Spanish is too broad, but you could learn jujitsu through the lens of this one technique, this one submission called the guillotine choke, which Marcel is very famous for. His particular variant on the guillotine is really brutal and called the Marcelo team, really, really technical. So could I learn the transitions, the timing, the setups for all of jujitsu by focusing on this one technique? And that was the choking challenge. But you can do the same thing with, say, trying to learn a foreign language by learning how to translate one poem, like your favorite poem or your favorite, you know, one page fill in the blank, right? I mean, it could be the Declaration of Independence into that language. Cardinal Mezzafanti, who is a famous hyper polyglot, learned by some accounts, he was tested in, I think, 32 languages, but was purported to speak up to 70. He used the Lord's Prayer. So his version of the guillotine for learning languages was the Lord's Prayer, and he would have native speakers translate for him into the Lord's Prayer. And that's how he started picking up all these languages. But the choking challenge was trying to throw the guillotine onto these monsters.
So
he marked the Lord's Academy.
That's one thing that I noticed was that in many of the episodes, like in the jiu-jitsu episode, you have to literally go in and fight with monsters. In the open water episode, you had to go out into the choppy surf. In the drumming episode, you had to perform live on stage in front of this massive crowd. And you seem to always have some kind of a drastic consequence or embarrassing outcome at stake when you specifically are learning something. Why do you think it is that more people don't set up this risk component when they're learning new things or trying to achieve a goal?
I think there are several explanations. One is that they don't really want to do it. It's just something on their wish list. And I have those too. Like, I've wanted to be able to do side splits between chairs like Van Damme since I was 12. And pretty much every year it's just somewhere on my, like, it would be really awesome if list. But it would be really awesome if it's kind of like someday when I have time and all the circumstances are perfect type list. I think that's one category. The second category is that people don't understand how valuable those incentives are in setting the stakes and how effective that can be at driving behavior change. I think it's people are like, what? Like, so-and-so bets his friend, or they have a running agreement that so-and-so will pay his workout partner $5 if he misses a workout. Like, I don't give a damn about $5. That's not going to change my behavior. But in fact, it probably would. They underestimate the psychological mechanisms at play. And, you know, as an example, like A.J. Jacobs, who's a writer for Esquire, is a buddy of mine, very good writer, and he's Jewish. But to finally lose weight, because he knew what to do, he just wouldn't do it. He wrote a check to the American Nazi Party for $1,000 and gave it to one of his friends, and he's like, all right, if I don't lose X number of pounds by Y point in time, I'm going to mail this into the party. And then that would put his name on record as having donated to the American Nazi Party.
Oh,
so he lost the weight. Long story short, though, it's like, I think we love to drown ourselves in how to, but the why to is a missing component that is really easy to engineer.
Yeah.
Right? Like, make a betting pool with some friends. It's like, you're not. I mean, it doesn't have to be complicated.
Did you stumble upon that strategy, or did it seem like hardwired into you as just something that makes logical sense as you grew up and as you began learning things?
It's something that I think I was intrinsically aware of, but really didn't start to think of as technique that could be used very elegantly until I had to think about how to get hundreds of thousands of people to change their diets and to lose weight. It's a very gnarly problem because it's harder for a lot of people, it seems, to change their diets than to quit smoking. It's really just insane on some level when you look at how difficult it is. And I wanted to make it easier. So I started looking at outliers who had never been able to follow a diet and then suddenly lost 120 pounds. And I was like, all right, well, what are the triggers? What are the commonalities across these anomalies? And in almost every case, there was some type of social or financial pressure, whether it was a reward or very often some type of loss or punishment, right? It wasn't enough to be like, if you do this right, you will win this money. It was like, if you do this wrong, you come in second place, you're going to lose the money you put into the pot. So it's like, if you have five people who have a weight loss competition over a quarter, you're not only eligible to win, but there's also potential for loss. And I think the stick, as opposed to the carrot, is really undervalued in the U.S. because we like to give everyone a trophy. But in fact, I think we'll try a lot harder to avoid losing $100 than we will to make $100. You know what I mean?
It makes sense. Well, over in the show notes, by the way, if you're listening in, I'll be sure and put a link to the Nazi party for those of you who are wanting to lose weight fast. So a few other questions about the TV show, Tim. Parkour is something that fascinates a lot of people. And, you know, we have a lot of active listeners who would love to be able to move like that and tackle obstacles like that. What was one of the bigger tips you learned in parkour? Like, for example, running up a wall is something that I think a lot of people would find a pretty cool skill to be able to do. Is that something you were able to master? Or did you pick up any other little tips or tricks that lend themselves to being able to be described via audio?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, running up a wall is an interesting example, and I did get to practice this a lot, where the physics that you think would propel you up a wall, namely like running up to the wall and then kicking off, but in a straight line upward, don't actually work that well. So you're trying to redirect forces. You're actually making an impact on the wall with, let's just say, your shin is at, you know, hypothetically 30 degrees off of the wall, as opposed to parallel to it. And then as you pop somewhat directly up, using a lift, almost like a reverse, like a glute ham raise or something like that. It's kind of like a reverse hyper movement. It's like a reverse hyper movement on one leg. You're using that, like, that terminal kind of hamstring movement, like kicking one leg back to then elevate your hips so that you can land on top of the wall on your feet as opposed to on your chest. Right. So with parkour, whether you're doing something called a cat to cat, which is like jumping, kind of like broad jumping and then landing on a wall where you catch with the both hands on top, or, you know, the movement that I was trying to tackle, which is very insane, but beautiful looking, called the double Kong, which is obviously unlike a single Kong, two Kongs in a row.
Are you saying Kong?
Kong, like King Kong.
Okay, double Kong. Interesting.
Double Kong. It is an amazing move, and people can see that on YouTube. They can check out what I was trying to do in 4 days, was learn to do a double Kong. That's how I tore one of my legs really badly. But you're constantly thinking about whether your hips are highest, shoulders are highest, or otherwise, and the relationship between sort of hip and shoulder elevation in parkour, and also redirecting forces. So, like, how can you take sprinting towards something and change that horizontal movement into a vertical gain? And the Kong is a great example of that. So those are a couple of things that you can take a look at. But parkour was definitely the episode in which I got most injured, for
sure.
Interesting.
And I'll find a video of a double Kong move, if anybody wants to see what that looks like, and put it in the show notes. How about Urban Escape? This one looks really cool. I've always wanted to take one of these Urban Escape and Evasion classes because they look fascinating. And you know, you can see, for any of you listening in, you can see if you go and watch the commercial, you know, of Tim, I believe, escaping from a zip tie by using a paracord. But in terms of evasion, the evasion component of Urban Escape, how do you actually lose someone fast when you're out in the streets or in an urban situation?
Yeah, if you're trying to lose someone quickly, and there are a lot of different techniques can be used, but obviously, number one, you have to blend in or become difficult to spot. There are a couple of easy approaches there, right? So if you have a hoodie or something like that, just lose the hoodie so that you change your appearance slightly. Going the wrong way down one-way streets as a pedestrian makes it a lot harder for you to be followed by a car, as does going through parking structures. If you have a little bit more time to prepare for such a thing, you can acquire other items that are very helpful, like a hard hat and a clipboard, for instance. Anything that can give you that position of invisible authority that people ignore is really effective for getting into just about any location you can imagine. But
are you allowed to do that during the class? Like, can you go into, say, like a hardware store and get a hard hat and a clipboard?
I would imagine that you're allowed to do it. I mean, in my case, I was being pursued by people in a car. So I actually saw a Greyhound bus dropping passengers off and ran over. Well, I didn't run over to it because it made it too obvious, but I walked over to it. Sort of briskly walked over to it. Like, I was trying to catch the bus. And then there's a guy getting off the bus. And I was like, "Hey, man, he looked like he was pretty hard up for cash."
Right.
Had a baseball cap. And I was like, "Can I give you 20 bucks for your baseball cap?" And he's like, "Sure, absolutely." And so I bought his baseball cap. And I mean, that right there is a very, very easy switch, but it makes it incredibly more difficult for you to track someone just with that simple type of switch of headgear. But in that episode, we covered everything from it. You saw the zip ties, and we did handcuffs, we did getting out of duct tape, we did lock picking, getting into cars that you can borrow in quotation marks in case of emergency. Very fun episode to do.
What organization did you go through to do your Urban Escape and Evasion course?
I worked with Kevin Reeve, who is On Point Tactical, and there are,
I believe I subscribed to their blog, the On Point Tactical.
Kevin's legit. He's very good with outdoor survival as well. He's one of the nation's best trackers.
Nice.
So the FBI and other law enforcement organizations have used him and his services in the past to try to find missing children and fugitives and so on, which is pretty cool. So he's as comfortable out of doors as he is in the urban jungle.
Now, you also have an episode in which you are shooting a pistol, a rifle, and a fully automatic, something called tactical shooting. And I've heard you remark before that was one of your favorite things that you did during the TV show shooting. Why was that your favorite?
It was definitely one of my favorites. Surfing with Leonard Hamilton was pretty high up there too. But the tactical shooting was really fun because I was competing against a friend in this case. So I had a friend along for the ride, Kevin Rose, who's always hilarious and very smart and very good at kind of hacking this kind of stuff as well. And I enjoy anything that involves marksmanship. So archery, shooting, I really enjoy how subtle it is and how the little things make a huge difference, right? So if you're holding a handgun incorrectly with a short barrel like that, as soon as you teach someone how to hold a handgun correctly, they go from grouping, i.e. how close their shots are together, it's the size of, like a wall, to grouping that is a dinner plate, and then you make one small tweak on top of that, and then suddenly they have like groupings within a 3-inch circle. And you can make progress very quickly by minding the details. And I get very excited about anything that allows me to do that, where you can make quantum jumps with tiny improvements and changes. And then there was the Jason Bourne like aspect, the swapping between, handguns, assault rifles, and shotguns as you run through a course as quickly as possible, shooting targets at different distances. And there's something very gratifying about shooting metal targets also, as opposed to paper targets, where shooting stainless steel, so you hear the like, ding, ding, ding of hitting the target.
Yeah,
massively,
it's very cool.
Gratifying. Yeah, it's super, super fun.
Have you caught much flack from the anti-gun movement?
Some people get their knickers in a twist about it. Other people find it interesting. And my point is, this is not a political statement that I'm making. I'm treating it as a sport, just like as you would treat the biathlon, say, in the Olympics. So there are some people who get their feathers ruffled, but that's fine. I think that on the internet, 10% of people will find a way to take anything personally. So you just have to expect that in advance so you don't change how you approach things.
Well, I'll use as the featured image of this post for any of you who want to go check it out, a photo of Tim posing next to the targets with what appears to be a machine gun. It's It's actually it was a very cool episode. I recommend that folks check it out. So Tim, I've got one last question for you, kind of coming full circle. The last couple times you were on the show, you actually were doing like cold showers and cold thermogenesis. And I'm asking this because I started doing this like whatever 3 years ago, around the time that I first had you on the show. And it's been hard for me to actually stop. It's like I have this habit now of just taking a cold shower every day and kind of exposing myself to something cold every week. Are you still doing much of that, like experimentation with temperature manipulation?
I am, yeah. And the cold is really addictive because it's such an incredible mood elevator, among other things. So I still do cold exposure. I just went swimming in the ocean here, not so long in New York, which is probably 52 degrees or so. Nice. Something like that at this time of year. But okay, I've also been playing around a lot with heat acclimation and trying to sort of trigger heat shock proteins and things like that. And Dr. Rhonda Patrick was the person who kind of turned me on to looking at that in a methodical way as a means of, say, increasing growth hormone and so on. So over the last few months, I've been doing a lot of not only heat exposure through dry sauna and steam rooms, but doing contrast therapy where I will go, I actually did this in my last podcast where I interviewed Rick Rubin, going from sauna or steam room to ice bath and back and forth.
Yeah.
Is something that I've been experimenting with.
That's amazing. That's Wednesday morning for me. I've got a giant cold swimming pool outside in my backyard next to a hot tub, and going back. Well, my strategy is 8 minutes of swimming in the cold, and then I'll go 2 minutes into the hot tub and do breath holds in the hot tub and then go back into the pool. And three times through is about a 30-minute routine. And you feel amazing afterwards.
Yeah. Oh, you feel incredible. Like all your worries just melt away. And I think that there are very inexpensive ways to do it too. I mean, you could use a lot of CrossFitters or use a garbage can. And you know, just getting the ice is a hassle. If you live in a city that Instacart operates in, you can use an app to order ice. And that's the only thing I use Instacart for, is buying bags of ice. And then you have that, and you could pair it with a hot shower, you know, if need be. So it doesn't have to be super expensive, but I am still definitely very keen on playing with temperature, and I'll be doing more of that as well.
So folks, if you learn anything from this episode, it's that Tim Ferriss approves of you basically sitting in a garbage can. You could probably set one up in your front driveway full of cold water to enhance your biology, and he's still doing it. So all of the resources. I took a lot of notes on everything from Siltep to Yerba Mate to the Double Kong parkour move to the Tim Ferriss Experiment TV show on iTunes. And you can check all that out at bengreenfieldfitness.com/Tim. And Tim, thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, my pleasure, man. And if I could just leave one more suggestion for people also, if they want to see the, you know, the books, the podcast, the TV show all in one place, you can also check it out at itunes.com/Tim Ferriss. They put all of my various tentacles in one location for convenience sake. But
nice.
Definitely also in your notes, people should check out the Double Pond. It's an insane move.
Nice. Okay. itunes.com/Tim Ferriss. This is Ben Greenfield and Tim Ferriss signing out from bengreenfieldfitness.com. Have a healthy day.
Visit BenGreenfieldFitness.com for even more cutting-edge fitness, nutrition, and performance advice.